Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop on this Thursday, March 5th. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Day today, and we welcome back Valerie Rapson of the Dudley Observatory and Bob Berman of the Farmer's Almanac and, what magazine? Astronomy Magazine, many others. Give us a call, 800-348-2551. If you have a question about Mars, comets, gravity, whatever, 800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. Astronomers Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson, and your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers on board today to answer your questions about the final frontier. One of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the whole world, Bob Berman, is here. Bob is the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. He's also written many books. How many books now? Seven? 12 books. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here. Valerie is the chief astronomer at the Dudley Observatory. She earned her PhD in astrophysical science and technology at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Her dissertation focused on the chemical composition and structure of planet-forming disks around nearby young stars. If you have a question about the heavens, good time to call us right now. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Bob and Valerie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Yeah.
Everybody's disinfected here in the studio. We're ready to go. We're ready
for
another show. Well, on this day, 38 years ago, 1982, the Soviet Union's Venera 14 spacecraft landed on Venus. Mm-hmm. I remember how excited I was about this. And it lasted about an hour. There were two. There was a Venera 13 and 14, and they launched within a week of each other. Venera 14 parachuted down. It landed about 600 miles away from the 13, started beaming back images. But it's like a living hell on the surface of that planet.
Yeah.
So
90 times Earth's air pressure and 850 degrees Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned that the winds can blow 400 miles an hour or something crazy like that. So it's not really a really wonderful place to be.
No, I mean, can you imagine 90 times Earth's pressure? I mean, a pressure cooker operates at double Earth's pressure. Here's 90 times with a temperature of 850, which is a lot hotter than a pressure cooker. So you have far more hostile than a pressure cooker. This is like the worst place in the universe. Hell is a good word for it.
Now, you know, I've been told that condition is enough to melt lead. How on earth was the Soviet spacecraft even able to last an hour?
I guess they didn't use a lot of solder.
Yeah. Exactly. I don't know exactly what they used, but I mean, they really didn't have a good sense of what the pressures and temperatures were going to be, so they just kind of crossed their fingers and hoped for the best.
And I mean, was it Bob is sometimes of the mind on this program that, gosh, you know, we don't need to send people to other planets. We'll send probes. In this case, was it worth even sending a probe there?
Did
we learn anything?
Yeah, the stuff you just said.
But didn't they know that in advance?
I don't think we knew the atmospheric pressure and the temperature. We did know that the atmosphere was carbon dioxide, and we did know that it's shiny, has the highest albedo or reflectivity of any planet. We knew that kind of stuff, but until you get down to the surface, you don't know what the surface is.
I had read some speculative article months ago, maybe a year or two ago, that it's possible that there could be life in the clouds above Venus. Did you read about that?
I didn't see that one. I mean, I suppose maybe, but the chemical composition isn't quite right. I mean, there's not really any water there. The things you really need for life probably aren't there.
It rains sulfuric acid, right?
Right.
Yep.
Most life doesn't like that. So.
No. Well, this presumably would be above the rain. Our number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. I was on space.com, and I saw this little bit of information about Venus, and then we'll move on, and I'll let you guys talk about this. A day on Venus lasts 243 Earth days. That's how long it takes Venus to make one rotation, while a year lasts 224 Earth days.
Right.
How does that happen?
Because it hardly spins. It's the slowest spinning object in the known universe. Do you know that on Venus, the rotation is so slow that if you were walking on the equator, you could keep up with it if you walked 4 miles an hour. So fast walk, a jog, wow. You could keep the sun from ever setting on Venus.
Do we know why, or do we have a theory as to why it turns so slowly?
Yeah, we do. We think it actually was hit by a large rock early on, shortly after it formed. Same kind of thing probably happened to Earth forming the moon and creating Earth's tilt. Mm. Whatever struck Venus literally probably flipped it upside down because it's also rotating the wrong way. It's rotating clockwise instead of counterclockwise. So it's upside down and it's rotating slowly. All suggests that it was hit by something.
So Velikovsky was right.
No, he was absolutely wrong.
Really?
He had the total. Well, but actually, he was right about that.
And he did predict that it was going to be a hellish condition on the planet, right?
Yeah, in his Worlds in Collision. I read that book in 1950. I didn't read it in 1950, but I was persuaded until you get further into Worlds in Collision. Did you ever read that, Valerie?
No, I didn't.
And because he had a lot of followers. That was what cultism was like back then. And the only reason he lost us astronomers, is because he started saying things like, yeah, Venus can explain the Bible stories. For example, the manna from heaven, as the Israelites were fleeing, and there was supposedly manna from heaven. Well, guess what? Pieces of a comet, which eventually became Venus, he said, without enough explanation, rain down on Earth. And guess what? That can happen because comets have carbohydrates. So the manna, the food, the breads from the sky were pieces of this comet that became Venus. And then if you read this, if you knew any science, you said, well, wait a second. Comets don't have carbohydrates. They have hydrocarbons. It's a little bit different. It's not something you'd want to munch on. Hydrocarbons is what you get a face full of if you are behind a bus and you get a face full of bus soot. So he got those basic terms wrong.
But comets can have organic material, right?
Yes, but do you know what organic means?
I don't know. It depends on if you're going to Whole Foods, I suppose.
No. Organic means containing carbon.
Okay.
That's all it means. A lot of people think organic means life, bearing life. But no, it just means there's carbon in it. So the whole field called organic chemistry is the study of things that have carbon in them. That's all.
Number here is 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson is here from the Dudley Observatory. Bob Berman is here from Astronomy Magazine. And let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551. Lori in Hyde Park. Hello, Lori.
Hi. How are you?
I'm well. And yourself?
Good. I'm good.
Good.
So my question is, I'm going on the special interest tour with Bob Berman in a couple of weeks.
No way.
Great. And, that's great.
Yeah, I'm really excited. But I've been watching this Aurora app I have on my phone, and unfortunately, it doesn't really look too good for us to actually see too much of the Aurora Borealis. But I know there's going to be a lot of other stuff to see up in the sky because it's going to be really dark and wonderful. So what are some of the other things that we can see on this tour?
Well, of course. Well, we'll be exploring the polar sky, but I'll say this. In the 25 or 30 years that we've been doing these tours every year to Alaska at special interest tours, we have never failed to see an aurora. So, knock on wood, I don't want to curse this, but when you say it doesn't look too good, forget that. There's auroras 2 out of 3 nights in this part of Alaska, and it's clear 2 out of 3 nights. So, when you have a week to spend there, as we will, just the math works out well for us. And we almost always, not almost, we have always seen auroras. So, don't worry.
I think Lori just jinxed it, frankly.
Well, we'll see.
No, I didn't want to totally rely on the app.
But we'll, of course, also explore the northern sky, the polar sky, and there's, we'll do dog sledding, and we'll hang out in a hot spring, a natural hot spring at night with the auroras overhead.
Yeah.
So we'll have fun.
All right. Well, good luck, Lori, and enjoy. Go ahead.
I was just wondering if we're going to get a good look at maybe the Milky Way or something that, I can't see here at Hyde Park.
Right. Well, for the Milky Way, I would come down to our Chile tour some year. We're not offering this year, nor am I going to plug it because that would be too commercial for public radio. Right, Ray?
Right, Bob.
I know my place. I know what to do and
good
not
for
to
you.
Do.
Good for you.
But the Milky Way At this time of year, yes, it runs through Orion. We'll see Orion. And Betelgeuse is coming back, by the way, that shoulder star.
Oh, it's brightening up again?
I just saw it the other night, and it's starting to brighten up.
Yep. All right.
So we'll see that. And, yes, the winter Milky Way will be seen. Yes.
All right. Well, Laurie, thanks for the call. So Betelgeuse, or Betelgeuse, depending on how you say it, is now brightening again. And we expected this, right?
Well, we didn't know when, and it was delayed so long that some of us were getting worried that maybe something really major and terrible is happening. But about three or four nights ago at our new observatory, Willow Observatory, the dome was open. We were looking at something else, and then there it was, that shoulder star just starting to brighten. And if you, I'm talking to all listeners here, if you can recognize Orion with those three stars in a straight line, just check it out and notice that its shoulders, the two main stars above that belt, one of them, Bellatrix, the right one, was matched exactly by Betelgeuse on the upper left. But now Betelgeuse is visibly brighter.
Oh.
And so night by night, I expect it to get brighter and brighter until it's way brighter than Bellatrix. So, but don't wait to read about it somewhere.
Take a look.
Take a look yourself.
And Valerie Rapps and some of your students at Siena were tracking this?
Yeah, they're attempting to. You know, we've got that huge telescope on the roof of the building there. So they've been taking a few pictures. It's been pretty cloudy here, so they haven't been all that successful just because of the weather. But,
yeah.
You know, we're trying to get some images and track it and match it with all the other data that Bob and other people are getting. So.
Oh, cool. Well, let's take a break here. It's Astronomy Today. 800-348-2551 is the number. Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson here to take your calls. We'll take more of them in a moment. Vox Pop, Astronomy Today, Ray Graff with you, 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Bob Berman is here, Dr. Valerie Rapson is here, and Edmund is in Kingston. You're on.
Hey there, thanks. So my question is, when I'm looking at a bright planet in the night sky, what side of the sun is it on? Is it up a far side of the sun and fully illuminated, or is it close on our side and a crescent?
Well, that's a great question, and it could be either. For example, Venus these days, as brilliant as it is just now moving from the far side, where it's been for the last several months, to coming along to our half of the orbit. When it comes to our half, it gets brighter, and then through a small telescope, it starts to look like a crescent, first a fat crescent, then a bigger but thinner crescent. So it can. The answer is can be either. And what's odd, listen to this. When Venus is at its brightest, it's on the near side and looks like a crescent. When Mercury's at its brightest, it's at its far side and looks like a full moon.
Mm-hmm.
So both of those planets have different reflective properties, have opposite reflective properties, and so they both do opposite things. Interesting.
Huh. All right. Well, thank you for that.
Thanks, Edmund. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Astronomy Today. Valerie, you were talking before we started about this incredible panoramic picture. It's actually a billion pictures or something.
Yeah, it's 1.8 billion pixels taken by the Curiosity rover on Mars of this Mount Sharp area that it's currently exploring. And I was spending my morning just like scrolling through this image because it's one of those where you can pull it up on your computer screen and just keep zooming in closer and closer.
Now, how many pictures did it take? It took several days to take this.
Yeah, it did it over Thanksgiving. So the scientists, of course, wanted to go home for Thanksgiving. So they set the rover up to just sit there and take a ton of pictures. They stitched them all together, and now we have this beautiful image.
You know, you see now where this rover is, and it's in the middle of this huge plain. I guess it's an enormous crater, and you can see the mountains around the outside. My question is, this rover, it can't get over those mountains. It's stuck in this area, right?
Well, it goes really slowly. So they try to navigate the shallowest parts of it so that it can get higher. And it has climbed up part of the mountain to explore different areas. So, yeah, I mean, it's not going to go up a 40-degree steep hill or anything like that. But they can still get it around pretty well.
I guess my quote—go ahead.
What I was going to say is the three of us were discussing Mars and the apparent finding of life on it in 1976. You brought this up, Ray, and I thought it was fascinating, and our listeners might find it.
All right, before we do that, though, let me ask this question about why they landed there with mountains on all sides, didn't that limit the vistas and the possibilities for this rover? Wouldn't it have been better to find a spot that wasn't in the middle of a gigantic crater?
Well, yeah, but the craters are very interesting because you've overturned some of the soil there, so you're seeing kind of fresher material. You don't have to dig to see what's below. And they also picked places where there might be signatures of water as well. So some of those smoother areas, while it's easier for the rover, are not nearly as scientifically interesting.
Now, Bob, we were talking about 1976 when the Viking lander... Was it Viking?
It was Viking.
Yeah, Viking landed, and we were talking about the fact that... You know, The big look here is to find life. And there was a scientist on that original landing who said, oh, yeah, we got the signatures.
If I remember right, his name was Gilbert Levin. And to this day, as you yourself pointed out a few minutes ago, he insists that we found life on Mars. Now, this is what happened. We were talking about it here, but let's quickly capsulize. The idea was that they would scoop a bit of Martian soil, put it in a damp, nutrient base, which they thought was like a kind of chicken soup type thing that who knows that maybe it would like, but it was radioactively tagged. I forgot whether it's carbon-14, but some radioactive source. And the idea was that here on Earth, life changes its environment, like when we breathe out carbon dioxide. And so if there was life there, it might take in these radioactive tagged substances, give off something different and change its environment, which would be detected by that experiment in the rover. And guess what happened? It was positive. Radiation increased. Then they took a second sample, sterilized it, did the same thing, and now the environment inside the lander did not change, which is just what they would expect if there had been life the first time, sterilized life the second. NASA, to everyone's amazement, put out an official analysis saying negative results, there's no life. We found no life. Mm. And when they were asked, well, what about the positive results? They said, we think it's some kind of unknown, strange chemistry, local chemistry, but not life. But Gilbert Levin, if that was his name, and I think it was, of the experimenter and many others to this day say, back in 76, we found life on Mars.
Mm. Well, presumably we'll find it again. We have enough technology up there now. The number here is 800-348-2551. And before we get back to the calls, speaking of finding life outside of this planet, did you guys see there was a discovery here in the water of a multicellular creature that does not depend at all on oxygen?
That was The Shape of Water. I saw that movie.
No. This is not. It's not a. No, it's. It's something that lives on salmon, and I guess it gives salmon a grayish, I don't know, it's some sort of parasite. But apparently it has evolved so that it no longer requires oxygen. They're not exactly sure how it survives, but they surmise that it may be pulling energy from the salmon itself.
That's cool. I hadn't heard of it, but that sounds really neat.
That would possibly change the equation in how one looks for life outside of the Earth, right?
Right. Sure. Well, we're all trying to be open and say life as we know it versus could there be people always say, could there be silicon instead of carbon-based life? And
Spock
we're trying to be open
Star Trek.
About that. But one thing's for sure. So far as we know, water is important. So as we've started to find water, first on Europa, the Jupiter's moon Europa, then on Enceladus, orbiting Saturn, and it's only in the last quarter century that we've gone from Earth being the only abode for water that we know of in the whole rest of the universe. I mean, we knew comets were mostly ice, but I'm talking about liquid water, to now suddenly there's a number of other places that have liquid water. So let's go there. And a lot of us are disappointed that the European Space Agency's plans to return to Europa is an orbiter. Because we all know what we want to do is land and then drill or burn our way through the ice and take a sample, and it's salt water on top of that, even more friendly to life, and see what, if anything, is swimming or floating there.
But Valerie, do you think that there are some ethical concerns with drilling into the ice?
Well, always. I mean, if we're going to search for life on other planets or other moons, whatever, we want to make sure that we aren't contaminating those planets with any, you know, creatures that might be on our spacecrafts accidentally. I mean, these spacecrafts go through very thorough decontamination processes to help that. But, you know, we try not to.
Like Apollo 12. Remember that infamous Apollo 12?
Vaguely.
When they landed and the astronauts hopped over to the old Surveyor spacecraft, which was planned, and they snipped off to see what 2 years on the moon in the moon's hostile conditions would have done, they snipped off some foam, brought it back to Earth, and they found a living bacterium, a streptococcus that was still alive after 2.5 years on the moon in the vacuum of space and with those temperatures of 230 degrees above and about the same amount below zero for 2 years, and it's still living.
Yeah.
So if you ever wondered why it's so hard to get rid of a sore throat.
Yes. Well, you know, I'm glad you brought up viruses because, you know, no one's talking about it. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Jennifer in Chester. Jennifer, you're on.
Hi, I have sort of a weird question. I heard that there's these startup companies that are going to or are already doing somehow shooting up and hitting meteorites to get some the metals out of it, and you know, thus selling it. Like what? I don't even know if there are metals that are worth selling in the meteorite, but it's I was reading from a finance magazine that this is going to be done, and I was wondering if you had any information on that.
Someday it may be done.
Someday. It seems silly because meteorites, there's a type called nickel iron, which you won't surprise to learn contains mostly nickel and iron, but these are metals that are freely available on Earth and a lot cheaper than going into space to mine them. The only other thing it contains is iridium and osmium, which are rare, but don't have that much value on Earth. That it's hard for me to see how iridium and osmium could be worth mining in space, but I could be wrong.
Right. It seems like it'd be much more costly to attempt to collect or to go up to an asteroid and mine for them and bring it back.
Mm.
Doesn't seem worth it.
Okay. All right. Thanks. I'll hold on to my money then. Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer. You know, remember, your results may vary. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Is there helium-3 on the moon? I heard that there were...
From fusion, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I thought that there was plenty of that. I thought that might have been something that they would like to mine at one point.
Well, there is. And that's caused by actually solar radiation hitting the moon and through a process of intermediaries can generate helium-3. And if there actually was such a thing as fusion reactors, helium-3 would be a needed fuel for that. However, we've not yet found an economic way to get electricity from fusion generators. And so thinking of going to the moon to get the helium-3 is at minimum for the future, if and when.
All right. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. Phil in South Hadley. Phil, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Very quick question. My wife and I are planning on going to Arizona in April, and one of the stops that we want to make is the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff. Mm-hmm. So first question, have either of you ever been, and any comments on it? And number two, apparently, Flagstaff has been designated as a night sky city or something like that. I'm not sure what they call it, but I'll hang up, and I appreciate your information and feedback. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil.
Yep, I've been there. Been happy to see that they sell one of my books in the store there at Lowell Observatory. And it's a worthwhile place to visit. And while you were there in Arizona, visit the Barringer Crater, nowadays called the Meteor Crater. That's another worthwhile astronomical type stop in Arizona because you're standing on the rim and it's the better part of a mile across. And that's really worth seeing, Valerie.
Yeah. Well, Lowell's on my bucket list. I haven't been there yet. I've been to Kitt Peak, Arizona twice, and the skies were absolutely beautiful there. I mean, I don't know exactly how far away Kitt Peak is from Lowell Observatory, but if you ever have a chance to just tour Arizona and check out all of the different observatories, it's really great. Totally
now,
worth it.
The Lowell Observatory, that's named after Percival?
Yeah.
Yep.
And wasn't he the guy who allegedly found the canals on Mars?
He did. In his 1906 book, Mars and Its Canals, he's the one who did the world a great disservice by elaborating on the Schiaparelli discovery in 1886. Mars came unusually close. It was 25 arc seconds across. It's as big as it can get. And thought he saw water channels, river channels, that he called channels. But unfortunately, the translation of channels into English is canali. And that was mistranslated as canals, and canals would mean artificial, and that means life. And so Percival Lowell, unfortunately, did the world no good by writing a book saying, Mars and its canals, read about it.
Imagine
and,
the scientists being wrong. That's amazing.
Yeah. So, but however, it was at his observatory that Pluto was looked for later on. Clyde Tombaugh discovered it on March 13th of 1930 at that observatory. And because, partially because it was at Percival Lowell's observatory, the first two letters of Pluto were named to honor him.
You know, you both have looked through telescopes for a long time. Valerie, I'll throw this to you.
Sure.
What is it now that could have accounted for someone presumably with a keen scientific mind to see channels or canals?
Well, there are a lot of features and cracks on Mars. I mean, you've got Valles Marineris, this huge, you know, Grand Canyon equivalent that's the size of the United States. And there are channels, in a sense, not man-made channels, but places where water has moved through and actually created these dried-up riverbeds now. So when you've got a, when you're looking at an image at lower resolution, you really can't see all the details. Sometimes these features do look like channels.
In other words, you imagine them.
Right. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson here to answer your astronomy questions. And let's now go to Chuck in Spencertown. Chuck.
Hey, how you doing, Ray? Great show.
Thanks.
Hey, the question I have is, you know, it's been talked about when our moon becomes into geosynchronous orbit with Earth. Is that any time in the future, or what is the talk about that?
Yeah, that's going to happen in the future, and but far in the future, because right now, here's the process. It's a very fascinating process. The moon and Earth are linked. And because the moon's tidal stresses on us are, especially because we have a bulge essentially facing the moon thanks to the moon's tides on Earth, and that bulge especially acts on where the oceans meet the shoreline, and so we're slowing down. Everybody knows our spin is slowing down. I think people are surprised when they hear how slowly. A day is 1/700th of a second longer after a century. So if you came back 100 years from now to the year 2120, you'd find each day 1/700th of a second longer.
Well, that's
after
good.
A century. That's pretty slow.
Yeah.
But it is slowing. And so the way it works in the universe is you can never lose energy. So the energy we lose, the moon gains. And so this energy is transferred, and the moon uses this extra energy to go to a higher orbit. And because of that, it's orbiting away from us by about an inch and a half a year.
Hmm.
Not very much, but that adds up too. So here's what happens. As the moon spirals farther and farther and farther away, and meantime, we're slowing down also. So there comes a time, and we're talking about in the far future, the better part of a billion years so far as I know, but I could be wrong about this, when we're, just as the caller said, we're geosynchronous. And that'll be when the moon's day, instead of being its current orbit of 27.32166 days, you know, I'm good at numbers.
Right.
That Earth, it's 40 days in orbit. And Earth by then will have slowed down to be 40-day day, and then we'll be facing each other just like Pluto and its moon Charon do, and we'll be in locked synchronously.
Hmm.
And you'd think, well, that would be the end of the story. That'll go on forever like that, but it won't, because now the sun steps into matter, because the sun has a tidal pull on us too. Mm-hmm. And because of that, the story doesn't end. Now the sun acts on the moon, and the moon then starts coming closer, loses energy because of the sun's tidal pull on the whole system, and the moon starts spiraling closer and closer and closer until it gets within our Roche limit. I love saying these words that that Valerie gets excited by with her doctor in astrophysics. Roche limit, R-O-C-H-E, which means 1.5 times Earth's radius. When an object comes that close, it can't hold up against the tidal forces, and the moon breaks into 2, 4, 8, 16 thousands of moon pieces until we have a
ring.
Ring.
Oh, thank you. Yes. no comments from the peanut gallery. Yes.
until we have a ring. Right. And so that's our future. Sorry, I gave you the
terrific
whole story.
But that'll be a few years down the road,
yeah,
right?
We got some time.
All right, sure. Chuck, thank you for that one. 800-348-2551 is our number. Valerie Rapson, Bob Berman here, and it's Astronomy on the program today. Pete in Albany. Pete, you're on.
Good afternoon. I used to live in Greenwich, Connecticut, in New York City, and we used to go up to, Westchester. We used to go to Greenwich on either Friday or Saturday night at a clear night, and they had, at the old Greenwich High School, they had a huge telescope that was open to the public. You'd go and they had a professor there or a teacher there who would take us through things, and it was just like an amazing, like this high school had a huge refractive telescope. It was enormous. I'm just wondering if there's anything like that around here where it's open to the public like that.
Well, Siena College definitely has the biggest telescope in the capital region. It's 27.5 inches, and they're open once a month for the public. Next one is March 27th, so a couple of weeks from
now
you
great
can come visit.
How do you find out more about that?
You can go to Siena College's website or dudleyobservatory.org. We've got the information there as well. But it's really great. A lot of students operating it, and they'll show you anything you want to see in the sky.
Very cool.
Great. Thank you very much.
Pete, thanks a lot. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson, Bob Berman here, and we'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC Astronomy Today. Ray Graff with you. The number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson are the experts. And this email came in from Michelle in Brunswick. Michelle writes, we're taking a road trip April 8th through 17th through several national parks, starting in Vegas. Is there a national park in Vegas? That sounds like my kind of park. And they're going to end up in Salt Lake City. We plan on hitting Grand Canyon, Zion, Arches, etc. Any suggestions of great places to stargaze at that time?
Bob's the tour guide. I'll let him take that.
Well, yeah, you just get away from cities. That's it. And out west, because the air tends to be drier out there, and they don't have the pesky obstructions we have in our region in the form of trees. I actually like trees, but out there there's fewer of them, and you actually get those vistas where you can see 60 miles in all directions. So also get to Death Valley. It's not too far from there, and that's a great place to stargaze, too. It's really dark.
And, it's very cold at night, though, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But any place away from cities, if you're willing to camp and have the facilities— But watch the calendar. Make sure you don't go during the bright part of the moon. Avoid the 1 week.
She's going April 8th through 17th.
Well, we'd have to see whether that's within 1 week of full moon. You want to avoid the full moon because that'll spoil the whole thing.
Well, you're both astronomers. You could tell me that, right?
Well, it's around full moon now. We're getting close to full moon now. So let's see.
So it'll be about 1.5 months.
It sounds like they're hitting it wrong.
Okay. Yeah, well, sorry about that, Michelle. Let's go back to the phones. And Toby in Cornwall. Toby, you're on.
Hi. Yes, I have a question about, I heard on the radio, I think last week or earlier on this week, that another moon had been discovered.
Yes.
Not very big. And I just wondered, was that orbiting Earth or some other planet?
No, it's the size of a Honda Accord.
Yeah.
It's tiny.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's it. Now, is it going around Earth?
Yeah, it's going around Earth, and I think it's going to stay for a little while. I forget exactly how long, but, I mean, the Earth is big, and it can capture these tiny asteroids all the time, and this one just happened to be noticed, and it was large enough to see, so... Yeah, I guess technically we have a second moon for a short time, but it's not going to really affect us or anything.
And then at some point it'll be flung back out.
It'll be recaptured by something else. It's unfortunate that English, with its 50,000 words and its richness, people in other languages sometimes envy English and our ability to say things with a lot of subtlety, is that we only have the word moon. If we use the word moonlit or other things like that,
satellite.
We could better describe, like take Jupiter. It's got four planet-sized moons. Ganymede is larger than Mercury, for example. Mm-hmm. Planet-sized moons, but then there are little pieces of debris, of junk, that some planets have that are 30 miles across, that are not round,
right.
That are irregular, that are just captured. Both of the moons of Mars are barely worth the name, Phobos and Deimos. By the way, worst names in the universe because it means fear and death. But here you only have 7 miles across on one and 15 miles on that other little orbiting piece of debris. So how do you compare that with something like 2,100-mile across Earth's moon, 3,200 miles across Ganymede or Titan of Saturn or Triton of Neptune. And so there should be different classes. So when they said a new moon found, that's why people were puzzled.
But
because
this is why people get interested in astronomy. You should be loving this, right?
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And
Toby's
and,
had enough.
I'll be looking out for a Honda Accord. Then, all right?
Fair enough.
Just
thank
flying
you.
By.
You know, it amazes me that science can predict pretty much when this thing will be set sailing out there, right?
Oh, yeah. As soon as we find it, we can track its orbital trajectory based on its distance and its speed and all of that.
Well, getting back to Bob's points about some of these so-called moons of these larger planets being tiny little things, what keeps them from being flung out into space?
Well, in many cases, they're way close enough to the planet because these are giant planets. Jupiter, Saturn, even Uranus and Neptune have a lot of mass to them, and they've got these things captured, and nothing is going to throw them away. Although one of the moons of Neptune, Nereid, goes so far away, something like almost a million mile orbit. Mm-hmm. It goes away and almost never comes back, and yet it's enough to capture it. And sometimes the gravity reaches out with like these little delicate fingers and goes farther than we think, which is why here you've got, a lot of people don't know this, but Pluto, you know the closest planet to Pluto? You would think it would be?
Uranus.
No, it is Uranus,
yeah,
but not Neptune. You'd think that the planet before Pluto, you know, when you name the planets, would be Neptune. No. Neptune can never come as close to Pluto as Uranus gets to Pluto because of the strange gravity. In the case of Pluto, it just so happens that to the second, three orbits of the sun by Neptune happen in the exact same time as two orbits of the sun by Pluto.
Well, be darned.
They are absolutely linked, and that's just to illustrate how the gravity can have these effects that go on essentially indefinitely, even to these great distances.
All right, back to the phones we go. 800-348-2551. Nina and East Hoosick. Hello, Nina.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
So I have two questions. One is a basic question, and I can't remember the answer to. Second one is, I think, largely directed to you, Bob. The first one is, I'm thinking about the line, you know, we are stardust. How is it that the composition of human beings and other organic forms on Earth are made out of stardust? So that's my first question. And my second one is this. You know, you have talked before, Bob, about perception, that, you know, we see, you know, the energy of, for instance, a tree. It's a little bit off astronomy, but it's something that you deal with, is, you know, really, you know, a mass of moving particles. But what is it that makes us, that is human beings? Is it the way that our eyes are organized, that we see it as solid form? What is it that creates that perception? So those are my two questions,
okay.
And thank you.
Well, these are big questions. I mean, when it comes to perception, there are many different ways to tackle this. For example, colors don't actually exist in the real universe. There are no colors out there. Now, all of us think that, well, here's a sunset over there. There's a rainbow over there. Aren't they out there, even if we're not watching them? No. Colors are created in the human mind in consciousness, because what's really out there are actually waves of magnetism and waves of electricity. That's what light is. They're waves, and neither light nor neither magnetism nor electricity has visual properties. Mm. So
our eyes are our radio receivers.
Yes, are receivers of this energy. Let's put it this way: they're receivers of electromagnetic energy, which are in turn composed of magnetism and electricity, and stimulated in that way. Our brains are designed architecturally so that we have a response within ourselves, and that response is the color yellow and the color red and the color green. But they are created entirely by ourselves as a response to this invisible energy that's hitting us. So the caller is saying that, you know, what creates it? Well, it's a whole architectural, wonderful creation,
yeah.
that was part of it. And the first part of that question was what? I like that even better, but can you briefly...
Oh, I got it. I can take the first one, yeah.
Sure, the first part of the... Oh, let me just restate it, if I may. It's sure. How are we, human beings, made up of stardust and other forms on the planet, organic forms,
right.
How is it that we came to be, as
Thank
it is
you.
Sometimes poetically expressed,
right.
made
yeah.
out of stardust?
Exactly, exactly. So you got to remember that stars, they're shining because fusion is happening in the core. You've got hydrogen fusing to helium, but there's also other processes that end up making things like carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. And when the stars reach the end of their lives, they explode or at least release this plasma into the universe. So anything that was generated in the fusion processes is now part of the galaxy, where new stars, new planets, and planets with potentially life on them are going to form. So much of it is created during the fusion inside of stars, and some of those heavier elements, they come from the supernovas, the most massive stars that die and explode. And in that final moment, things that heavier than iron are created. So basically anything heavier than hydrogen and helium had to be created inside of a star or during a star exploding.
Well said. And I would add to that I used to say, just as you're saying, mm-hmm. that the heaviest elements, iron, let's say, is created within stars and then are given off by a supernova explosion. But the truth is the Big Bang started with just plain vanilla hydrogen and helium and a little bit of lithium in the mm-hmm. early universe, just, you know, so it wouldn't be Keep everything calm and not
right.
too depressed. But as stars go through their fusion cycle, as Valerie said, it's hydrogen to helium, but the very next creation is helium creating carbon and oxygen. Mm-hmm. So that old stars, common white dwarf stars, I think of the nearest 100 stars, 6 of them are white dwarf, they're very common. Very, very common creation is hydrogen, oxygen and carbon.
Wow.
And of course, those are elements very much in our bodies and right. vital for life. And so, yeah, without the stars, we wouldn't have it within ourselves. So,
all right. Well, Nina, thank you for that one. 800-348-2551, the number. Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson are here. Bill is in Rosendale. Bill.
Hi.
Hi.
So, what we know about in terms of quantum theory and indeterminacy, as it affects the micro level of electrons, et cetera. And I was wondering if there was any indication of quantum physics relating to the macro level in the universe.
That's kind of the big problem we have right now, is that the quantum mechanics in many cases don't match the predictions that we have on the grander scale. So, of course, all of the
right.
science is interconnected, but right now, some of the things that we think about at the quantum level don't match when we start to scale it up. The mathematics don't work out. The numbers don't work out. So that's
Doesn't
one of the big problems. It does. It troubles a lot of people. And there's a lot of really smart people, way smarter than me, that are trying to solve this problem and figure it out.
We even have a name for it. It's called the classical quantum transition. Why do the laws that happen in the quantum world, where you can have two things happening at once, for example, in the quantum world, an electron isn't traveling this way or this way. It's traveling in both paths.
Mm-hmm.
It's taking every possible path at once. And that's called superposition, being in a state of superposition. In other words, the light switch is both on and off in the quantum world. Now, our
right.
regular classical world doesn't operate like that. At which point does it change over? That's called the classical quantum
yeah.
transition. And what causes it? And it's
and
guesswork.
Where is the transition?
Well, it's a certain size, actually.
Where that is? Do we have a map that says, okay, the transition is here?
Yeah, we do. Because in our world, if a ball is hit at a ballpark, it's either going to go fair or foul. It's not going to be both fair and foul.
Right.
But in the
depending on the umpire.
World,
right.
Yeah.
Imagine if it was. Oh, man.
And there's some believe that it's interference like with a gravitational field. Some say that just the interaction with the multiple atoms and molecules that we have in our classical world is enough to do it. So it's still, theorists are still working on this, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Bill,
yeah.
Aren't you sorry you asked, Bill?
In an everyday sense, if a grain of sand falls on me, I'm not even going to feel it. But as Mel Brooks says, don't throw that rock at me, you know. Is there any parallel there to, in other words, it's a matter of scale? Is there a scale? This is it, right?
Yeah. It's really just a matter of scale.
All right,
yeah.
Bill, thanks a lot for the call. I just think it's odd that we're missing some piece of this puzzle.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. We know that we're missing a piece of the puzzle.
Shouldn't all the laws sort of be the same? The speed of light is what it is? And
well, the laws are the same. It's the mathematics that describe them can be different. I mean, look at what Einstein did, right? When you're traveling at close to the speed of light, the laws are the same, but the mathematics is different that describes what's going to happen. Mm. So I think we're missing pieces to interconnect all of it.
And they're big pieces.
Well, that's your homework for the next show. I want these pieces.
Einstein hated it because you're also dealing with locality, whether that's real. And this means that is there a real world if we're not observing it? Or is the observation the only thing that creates reality, that without the observation, there is none? Now, brilliant physicists have said that the only phenomena that are real are observed phenomena. And until they're observed, they're not real, and have given examples that you can actually do it experimentally to show that this is the case. And Einstein was hated the idea that something can affect something else without touching it or without there being an intermediary like an electrical field or gravitation.
What did he call that?
And this is called locality. In other words, we would expect that, yes, a flag will wave if struck by wind down in Saugerties. But that flag is not going to be flopping around because there's a peasant revolt going on in the Andromeda Galaxy. And that has nothing to do with Saugerties at all.
Right.
And yet that's the case in physics, that things that are not in contact with other things have an effect.
All right. Well, now I'm sorry I asked. Let's take another call. John in Richmondville. John, you're on.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I had a question. You were talking about canals and being formed by water on Mars not too long ago, and I was wondering how that could possibly happen if water freezes at 32 degrees. Has Mars warmed up above the freezing point of water?
Right. Well, I think the key here is the salt content and the other things that are mixed with water. It's different than what we have on Earth, and Mars does actually, in the Martian summertime, get up to about 70 degrees Fahrenheit every once in a while. So. Yeah, I mean, not for long, but it does.
And if I may jump in here, there's something even more important than temperature, and that is pressure. Mm-hmm. Liquid water can only exist under pressure. And that's why if you went to Mars, where the air is only 1% the pressure that we have on Earth, and you brought water, it would immediately disappear. It would boil away and vanish because you need pressure. On Earth, our atmosphere supplies the surface pressure.
Right.
So the fact that we see fluvial channels on Mars means not just that it had to be warmer, but that there once had to be an atmosphere that it doesn't currently have.
Right, and we're pretty confident that that was the case, that there was a much higher pressure.
And one of the rovers is now finding micro-earthquakes or a lot of earthquakes.
Yeah.
And I guess they surmise that there's some magma left, but it's still cooling.
Yeah, that's the InSight lander. So a little bit different than the rovers, but yeah, it's detecting all of those quakes.
Well, let's get one more call in here before we wrap up. Mike on the throughway. Mike, you got about 30 seconds here.
Hey, you there?
Yep, you there?
Okay. Oh, listen, I just wanted to touch on the James Webb telescope. I think we should talk about that a little bit. Everything is riding on this $12 billion two-decade-old thing. And also, one of the things I heard about the James Webb telescope is it has about 10 years of fuel. Can we refuel it? It's never even going to make it there, so don't answer that. And also, mining the moon, What is the potential of mining the moon?
Okay, we have 30 seconds here.
We'll just do the
first
question.
We put a lot on our plate.
Right. Well, fire away.
Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, James Webb is awesome. It's going to go up. It's going to succeed. You cannot refuel it. It's not going to be in a location where astronauts or other spacecrafts can easily go to that position and leave. But it's going to do great for at least 10 years, and hopefully it'll last longer
than
that.
Yeah, and what Valerie's is omitting is that it's a bad idea.
Why?
Because it's being sent where no one can ever fix it.
Right. You get trapped
there. As we saw with the Hubble Space Telescope, things break.
It's a million miles away? Is that it?
This is going to be on the far side of the moon.
Yeah.
In 10 years, we'll be there like that.
It's not that easy.
We can't repair it.
Well, you know what? We're done. This was fun. Thank you so much for being here. Support comes from Merritt Bookstore, Millbrook. Books and toys for all ages. Book club meeting for the memoir, The Yellow House, on March 7th, MerrittBooks.com. Interactive Media Consulting, a team of online market strategists providing websites, branding, and digital marketing to the Capital Region and beyond since 1996, HighMediaConsult.com. Well, that was a good hour, and I'm not that surprised. They're usually pretty decent. Bob Berman, thank you. Valerie Rapson, thank you. And thank you for listening. Great calls today. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phones answered today by Jim Harrison. Our producer is Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, Missy Lieb from, is it Ioka or Loka Valley? I think it's Ioka Valley Farm, joins us to discuss maple syrup. We'll be living La Vida Ioka tomorrow on Food Friday. Stand by now for the Capital Connection.